In past years, on the Sunday closest to Independence Day, it has been my habit to offer a sermon that explores a point where our faith and our history meet. And I propose today to continue with this tradition. I'd like to do so by exploring what I believe to be one of the great pieces of American theology. This is something that was not produced by Martin Luther King or Reinhold Niebuhr or Jonathan Edwards, but instead the second inaugural address of Abraham Lincoln. Frederick Douglass observed after hearing Lincoln's speech that the address sounded more like a sermon than a state paper. What I propose to do today is to walk us through the speech and along the way to offer observations. And my hope is that when we are done, you will agree with Douglass that this was indeed a sermon, indeed a great one. Now, I suspect most of you do recall this from your history lessons in school, but for those of you who may have forgotten, when you hear me say that I'm going to read the entire second inaugural address, recall that it is 703 words long. Not like some of the other offerings from some other presidents. But what a 703 words these were. Fellow countrymen, at this second appearing to take the oath of the presidential office, there is less occasion for an extended address than there was at the first. Then a statement, some in detail, of a course to be pursued seemed fitting and proper. Now, at the expiration of 4 years, during which public declarations have been constantly called forth on every point and phase of the great contest, which still absorbs the attention and engrosses the energies of the nation, little that is new could be presented. The progress of our arms, upon which all else chiefly depends, is well known to the public as to myself. And it is, I trust, reasonably satisfactory and encouraging to all. With high hope for the future, no prediction in regard to it is ventured. Here in this first paragraph, Lincoln has told his audience, those who are gathered in front of the Capitol and those who will be reading accounts of the speech in the newspapers, what it is he will not be doing. He is not going to offer a report on the progress of the war. He is not going to laud the victories of the Union armies. He is not, as some might have expected, to indulge in presidential gloating. Nor is he going to outline a program for governance for the next 4 years. No. Here he says what he is not going to say. And he does that because he wants to clear the space so he can say what he believes America needed to hear. So he starts to set the stage. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. Both parties deprecated war, but none of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. Here, Lincoln does something remarkable. He shows the common humanity of both parties to the conflict, of Northerner and Southerner, neither wanting war. They all dreaded it. They all sought to avert it. Yet, While he notes this shared humanity, he does not engage in moral equivalency. He notes that there is a difference between the two sides. Both parties deprecated war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. North and South had different agendas. They hoped to meet their goals without taking up arms. And yet, the war came. And the war came, Lincoln says. Not the South launched a war. Not the states embarked upon a civil war. Instead, and the war came. Something greater, something elemental than people could imagine, unfolded and enveloped the nation. What could have caused this to happen? Lincoln begins to explain. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. To strengthen, perpetuate, and extend this interest was the object for which the insurgents would rend the Union, even by war. While the government claimed no right to do more than to restrict the territorial enlargement of it. Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with or even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph than a result less fundamental and astounding. Here, Lincoln sets forth some facts, but he also offers an implicit confession. Slavery was at the heart of the conflict. The war was not about states' rights. The war was not about a rebellion against tyranny. It was about slavery. Everybody knew it. The difference, though, around slavery was more nuanced than people might recall. Yes, the South sought to strengthen and perpetuate, to extend the remit of slavery. But the North, at the beginning of the war, did not take up arms to abolish slavery, but merely to stop its spread. And Lincoln here includes himself among those who had that limited aim at the time. Yes, long before the war, he spoke publicly about the evils of slavery, about how wrong it was. But he balanced moral imperative with political need. His primary goal had been to preserve the Union, and if that meant letting slavery continue in the South, then so be it. We will see that Lincoln came to reject that limited view. And the way he did it is remarkable. Because at this point, in his address, he began to do something that presidents do not normally do when delivering an inaugural. He began to talk religion. And not the religion of slogans, not the religion of God bless America, but instead the kind of religion that shows deep thought and reflection on God and God's purpose in the world. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask of just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge, not that we be not judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. The Almighty has his own purposes. Many of us have encountered these words multiple times over the years. Perhaps you've visited the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and seen them on the wall, read them in our textbooks. They're part of our historical record or our national story. We take them for granted. But just imagine what it might have been like to hear a president of the United States say these things. Lincoln lived in a society that was profoundly more religiously oriented than ours is. Broadly Protestant, rooted in the King James Version of the Bible. And yet, what Lincoln said would have been jarring to people because he wasn't offering the usual platitudes about God's blessing or assurance of divine favor on the American enterprise. Instead, here he lifts up a paradox about how two contesting parties with irreconcilable goals and hopes were praying to the same God for diametrically opposed outcomes. And here Lincoln does not say, and of course our side is right. Instead, he says, we should be cautious before we start judging. When Lincoln here talks about judge not that we be not judged, he is directly citing Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7, verse 1. It is the first of four times that he will draw on the deep well of Scripture in this address. Lincoln read the Bible all his life. It was a source of deep inspiration for him. Now, this is not to say that Lincoln was an Orthodox Christian the way we might recognize one. Even during his lifetime, people were arguing about whether he believed in God and what his faith might be. But we do know that he grew up in a primitive Baptist church that was shaped and formed by Calvinist theology, the theology that grew out of the Puritans here in New England. We know that he was an inquisitive and seeking individual throughout his life. And we know that he attended church regularly, especially as the war drew on. He was there to be seen in the pulpits of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church. Lincoln was thinking about God and reflecting on God and drawing on Scripture to try to make sense of what was going on. And so he says, the Almighty has his own purposes. Here Lincoln talks of providence, of a God who rules the universe and yet is giving scope and room for people to exercise free will. This is the God that Lincoln focuses on in the second inaugural address. A God who has his own purposes. This was not what the people in the audience expected to hear. He continued, woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. Matthew 18, verse 7. That verse comes from the passage in which Jesus has invited the little children to come forward and says, woe to anyone who serves as a stumbling block to them. Perhaps we would accuse Lincoln of a little proof texting here, but I don't think that's right. He recognizes the gravity of engaging in actions that can lead others astray. Offense is a loaded word in this context. Lincoln is talking about sin. And what is that sin of which Americans need to be mindful of? If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in the living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. America's offense, America's sin is slavery. And notice how Lincoln refers to American slavery, not Southern slavery, not generic slavery, but American slavery. This is something in which the entire nation is complicit, both North and South, the Union and the Confederacy. And it is for this sin that America is being judged, that it is being scourged with war. And in using that word, Lincoln is referring to Hebrews 12:6. For whom the Lord loveth, he chastiseth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. God cares about people. God cares about the nation, but he will judge them. Remarkable for a president of the United States to say this. And he includes himself among those who are being judged by God. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, still must it be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Lincoln, as much as any other American, wanted the war to come to an end. But if God willed that it should continue, then he felt that was just. You recall in the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln's referring to 47 years ago, back to the Declaration of Independence. Here, as he talks about the sin of slavery, he goes all the way back to the first days of America, 250 years. And he lifts up the enormity of the sin and recognizes the incredible debt that the nation has incurred through its oppression and enslavement of African Americans. Lincoln's closing remark there, that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, are drawn from Psalm 19, verse 9. And that psalm is a hymn of praise to God and God's creation. It's an important pivot point, because the word of judgment is here attached to hope. When Douglas said that Lincoln's inaugural address sounded more like a sermon than a state paper, it wasn't just because of the language and imagery and ideas that were being shared. It's because this was a sermon. Lincoln's second inaugural address perfectly maps out to the Puritan form of the Jeremiad, in which the preacher would begin with what's known as the indicative, laying out all the things the people had done that were wrong and how they had strayed from God and were heading down the wrong path. Now, oftentimes, those Puritan divines preaching those Jeremiahs would talk about the things that you had done in chastising the church. But Lincoln included himself. And the Jeremiad, towards the end, would shift from this bill of particulars of the things that people had done wrong to the imperative, the call to action and reform. And it was in that call to action that hope could be seen. And so Lincoln closes by sharing words beloved by Americans throughout the ages: with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. These are not throwaway words. They're not the product of some professional speechwriter seeking high approval ratings for his boss. These are Lincoln's words. There's no evidence that Lincoln had any help writing or editing this speech. This was his hope. This was his desire. When we hear the second inaugural address, when we read these words, it's hard for us to not remember what happened just a few weeks later. Lincoln dies at the hand of an assassin. But when he delivered these words, he was beginning his second term as president. He envisioned at least 4 more years in the White House. He was going to be a peace president and lead the rebuilding of the nation. And there were competing visions as to how the peace should unfold. There were those members of Lincoln's own Republican Party, the Radicals, who sought to treat the South as a conquered alien nation, to impose punitive measures. That was not the Reconstruction that Lincoln sought. He wanted to bind the nation's wounds, to heal what had been broken. And yet in doing that, in fostering reconciliation between Northerners and Southerners, he had also in mind those Americans who were black. When Lincoln talks about caring for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan, Lincoln is including those African Americans who were enlisted in the Union ranks, who took up arms to fight for the United States. At the beginning of the war, Lincoln shared many of the prejudices of his fellow Americans, and he was skeptical of the idea of enlisting blacks into the army. He didn't know how hard they would fight. He was worried that they would flee. But necessity required that. And as history shows, African Americans fought with incredible valor and distinction and bravery and commitment. And Lincoln recognized that. And his views changed. And by the end of the war, he was ordering the army to give pensions to the widows and children of black soldiers. And many of those soldiers were liberated slaves whose Marriages had never been recognized because in the South, a slave could not legally be married. Lincoln focused on what was just. Lincoln focused on what was right. Lincoln was willing to grow and change and expand his view, and this was all because of his engagement with what he thought God was trying to do in the world. The word theologian is derived from the Greek God talk. Theologians talk about God and they think about God. And Abraham Lincoln did this in as profound a way as any American who has ever lived. The vision of a healed America that Lincoln wanted to bring about was something that did not happen. You remember from our history books and classes how Reconstruction was an utter disaster, creating space and room for the advent of Jim Crow, the festering of animosity, and in many ways a lost century to this country. Yes, we've made some progress since the 1960s. But as we reflect on the events of recent weeks, we know there is still more work to be done. As Lincoln said 150 years ago, with malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. The work Lincoln spoke of is work to which we are called this day. On the evening after the address, as was customary back in that time, there was a reception at the White House to which the public was invited. More than 6,000 people came. Amongst those who showed up was Frederick Douglass. The police tried to turn him away. Apparently, they weren't listening to Lincoln during the address. They thought, this is a black man. We can't let him in. Frederick Douglass was, among many things, a very enterprising individual. And he made his way into the White House. And some security officials inside again tried to usher him out. But he caught the attention of Lincoln. And Lincoln saw him. And he called out to Frederick Douglass, invited him to come over, making a show of the fact that he knew this man. And he had a relationship with him. And Lincoln wanted to talk with him about his speech. And Douglass had just wanted to make the point that he could be present there and didn't want to take up Lincoln's time. Lincoln said, no, I want to hear what you have to think about it. I value your opinion more than any other man I know. Douglass said, Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort. The second inaugural address, a sacred effort. We hear these words today as Americans, and hopefully we draw from them inspiration about what we can do and what we can achieve as a people. But we also hear them today, I hope, as people of faith, drawing encouragement from what thinking about and reflecting on God's work and will in the world can enable us to do as individuals and as a community. On this Independence Day weekend, as we celebrate our national story, one of the figures who is lifted up is Abraham Lincoln, president, prosperous attorney, one-term member of Congress, by his own admission, an undistinguished soldier. Perhaps the most successful failed candidate for the Senate ever. Raconteur, reader, husband, father, and dare I say it, great American theologian.